Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Pakistan's Supreme Court resumes hearing on the dismissal of a no-confidence vote against Prime Minister Imran Khan and the dissolution of Parliament. A new survey finds that suffering has reached unprecedented levels in Afghanistan, with almost the entire nation experiencing dire conditions. And North Korea threatens to use its nuclear weapons to eliminate the South's army if Seoul decides to launch a preemptive strike. Thanks for joining us. Pakistan's Supreme Court resumes its deliberations on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan's decision to dissolve Parliament to avert a no-confidence vote was legal. Khan lost his parliamentary majority last week, facing a no-confidence motion. Speculations of the Prime Minister losing the vote had been running rife, but the Deputy Speaker blocked the debate on the motion on Sunday, triggering a full-blown political drama. The crisis deepened after Khan asked the presidency to dissolve the National Assembly, calling for a snap election. The United Opposition is calling that decision unconstitutional. Khan's cabinet has been dissolved as well in anticipation of fresh elections. The Prime Minister is accused of failing to revive the economy and cracking down on corruption. But Khan blames foreign conspiracy and says the opposition figures have colluded with the U.S. to topple him. Washington says it has nothing to do with the current turmoil in Pakistan. While suffering at its peak in Afghanistan, a new study shows that almost all Afghan people consider their living conditions to be so dismal to characterize as suffering. According to the Gallup survey, 94% of Afghans have rated their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. This is the highest level measured for any country since 2005. The study shows that the percentage of women suffering is higher than men and that women are more pessimistic about their futures. With the entire world now focusing on the conflict in Ukraine, Afghanistan has been deprived of the tension and the humanitarian assistance it much deserves. The situation has become even worse since the Taliban takeover last year, with the world refusing to recognize the Taliban government and the United States freezing billions of dollars worth of Afghan assets. Humanitarian aid to the country has almost entirely dried up. North Korea warns that it will attack Seoul with nuclear weapons if it chooses military confrontation or makes a preemptive strike on Pyongyang. The warning came from Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. On Friday, South Korea's defense minister said that Seoul had accurate missiles which could, quote, quickly hit any target in North Korea. Kim said it was a very big mistake for the South Korean minister to talk about an attack on the North. However, she added that Pyongyang opposes war and does not view South Korea as its principal enemy. Tensions have been rising on the Korean Peninsula since last month, when the North resumed testing intercontinental ballistic missiles after a five-year pause. Earlier, we were joined by writer and political commentator Brian Berletich to get his thoughts on North Korea's nuclear threat against the South.
And the nuclear threat came after these very needlessly reckless comments coming from South Korea. People have to remember that there are some about 20,000 U.S. troops in South Korea that the U.S. has for decades designated the Korean Peninsula as one of its principal fronts to encircle and contain China. And they have maintained this environment of belligerence toward the North all of these decades. And the threat is real. The U.S. has carried out serial wars of aggression around the globe, and they are sitting there right on North Korea's border. So I think North Korea's perception of a threat is legitimate, and I think their comments were very measured. They were threatened first by South Korea, and they responded by saying there will be retaliation, but we do not see South Korea as a threat, as an enemy, or as an enemy. So I think this all could have been avoided if South Korea would just focus on coexistence and moving forward together with the North rather than this needless saber rattling.
South Korean farmers and fishers have protested against the government's plan to enter into another free trade deal, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for a Trans-Pacific Partnership. Hundreds gathered and marched on the National Assembly, worried that further opening of their industry to cheaper goods from abroad will destroy their livelihoods. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Hundreds of South Korean farmers and fishers protested in the country's financial and political center, Yeouido, demanding the government reconsider its intention to enter into yet another free trade agreement. The Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, will follow in the footsteps of previous rounds of deals. The critics argue usher in cheap foreign goods and jeopardize domestic producers.
In the past, during the Uruguay round, the government made fun of the farmers once, and then during the South Korea-US and South Korea-China FTAs, they deceived our farmers a second time. With the indoctrination of the CPTPP, we are about to be deceived a third time. Should we be deceived?
The 11-member CPTPP includes Vietnam, Australia, Japan, Canada, and Mexico. South Korea only a month ago joined a 15-member trade bloc led by China, as Seoul moves to open 90% of the country's agricultural market. Farmers and fishers demand consultation.
When the government tries to introduce this type of thing, it has to have some policies prepared. Discussing with farmers to some extent, and there should be some hope for agriculture and rural areas. But I don't think it should be pushed unilaterally like this.
Proponents say South Korea's high-tech export-led model needs all the help it can get, with the CPTPP deal set to boost the country's GDP by 0.3%. South Korea's own Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy recognizes the negative impact such free trade deals have on those gathered here outside the country's National Assembly. With a corporate-friendly conservative president set to take office here in May, these farmers' concerns over their livelihoods will only grow. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Officials in China's largest city and economic hub, Shanghai, are extending restrictions on transportation amid a surge in COVID outbreak. The restrictions will see more transportation networks, including subway lines, suspended. The entire population under lockdown was tested for Omicron on Monday. The mass testing raised the number of asymptomatic infections by almost 25% to over 13,000. Officials have also extended the lockdown to Shanghai's western parts. That means more than 25 million residents will be under restriction until further notice. Tens of thousands of medical and military personnel are overseeing the operation, the biggest since the shutdown of Wuhan, where the first known COVID outbreak took place in the early 2020. It's day 41 of the Russian military offensive against Ukraine, and here is a quick rundown of the theater of war. The White House claims that Russia is shoring up its campaign in eastern Ukraine with probable plans to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers there. The U.S. says Russian forces are pulling away from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, in a shift toward the eastern regions. Ukrainian officials also say that Russia is preparing for a big attack in the east and have urged mass evacuations in that region. Moscow says its drawdown near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv is a goodwill gesture to support peace talks. Ukraine and its allies say that Russia was forced to shift its focus to eastern Ukraine after suffering heavy losses near Kyiv. In the south, heavy fighting reportedly continues around the besieged city of Mariupol as Russian forces try to take the city. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team has not been able to reach Mariupol to evacuate civilians due to security conditions. That was the fourth attempt in as many days to reach the city. The Russian foreign minister says Western leaders should examine their own conscience before accusing President Vladimir Putin of committing war crimes in Ukraine. Lavrov's remarks came after earlier on Monday U.S. President Joe Biden called for his Russian counterpart to be tried for what he called committing war crimes in the Ukrainian town of Bukha. Asked about Biden's comments, Lavrov said the West should first consider its own actions in Iraq and Libya. He said, quote, "not all is well with the conscience of American politicians." Separately, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Washington will consult with its allies about Russia's accountability. Solomon said the case of alleged incidents in Buka could be referred to the International Criminal Court. Kyiv claims the recently found mass graves in Buka and other areas near the capital contain bodies of hundreds of civilians executed by Russian troops. Moscow points the accusing finger at Ukraine, saying it has fabricated images of dead civilians to smear the image of Russia. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Western countries' accusation that Russia has committed war crimes in Ukraine is in line with their attempts to create a propaganda campaign against Moscow.
They're interested in psychological warfare and propaganda. That's why the British have held up any inquiry into this incident at the United Nations Security Council, most likely because the British know that they'll be found out to having been involved. The British were instrumental in the White Helmet theatrical operations in Syria, where they would pretend that individuals were wounded or killed, and they were found to be crisis actors. So the British are very well aware that they are most likely going to be exposed as creating this propaganda. They've already been exposed as having Polish film crews hiring actors to pretend that there's all sorts of chaos. And, of course, the United States is desperate to try and provoke some sort of international outrage against Russia. So it is no doubt that this is completely fabricated, dramatic, and it fits the perfect model that NATO has always pursued. They did this in Libya as well when they invented a city in Qatar and pretended that it was Tripoli and did filming of operations there, pretending it was in Libya when it was not. They've also filmed fake beheadings in studios with cameras and studio lights, pretending that it was done in the desert in Libya when it was not.
Tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine take a new turn as France says it has decided to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. A French diplomatic source says the country will expel 35 Russian personnel with diplomatic status. The French Foreign Ministry also said the activities of Russian diplomats were considered contrary to security interests of Paris. The decision was part of a wider European initiative after Germany announced it expelled 40 Russian diplomats. The German Foreign Minister described the move as a response to what she called the unbelievable brutality Russia had unleashed in Ukraine. Moscow has denounced Berlin's move, calling it an unfriendly act which would worsen bilateral ties. The Kremlin also vowed to respond to Germany's move. Earlier, Lithuania said it expelled the Russian ambassador and would recall its envoy in Moscow. As the cost of living crisis continues to hit families across Europe, Britain's Muslims are struggling to feed their fasting families this Ramadan, as one charity claims. The news has sent shockwaves as more desperate people must resort to food banks in order to have an iftar meal. Rob Carter reports from London.
Shocking statistics released by a Muslim charity last Friday revealed that a staggering half of all Muslim households in Britain will not have enough money to feed their families when breaking their fast this Ramadan. Islamic Relief estimated that half of all British Muslim households are living in poverty. That's 1.6 million people compared to the 18% of the population in general. The UK is going through a major financial crisis, with the COVID pandemic and the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine pitted as the two main contributors towards skyrocketing inflation and a lack of fuel supply. As poverty spreads, food banks come under increasing pressure to deliver. Speaking to Press TV, London-based Sufra explained their concerns for the situation.
Muslim families in the borough are particularly affected, especially due to the housing benefit cap, for example, which disproportionately affects families that have more than two children, which, you know, applies to a lot of Muslim families. And so there are families that are living in inappropriate accommodation and not accessing the benefits that they should be entitled to because of these unfair policies. All we're doing is seeing numbers rising. We're hearing firsthand from guests how worried they are, especially now that we're in April, we're in this new financial year, and the guests that are coming through the door are extremely worried about the energy bills that are going to hit them this month.
During Ramadan, Muslims who can afford it make a religious donation to help others less well off, called zakat. With the economy wavering, more will be forced to rely on this generosity of strangers just to survive. Robert Carter, London.
A new study has shed light on the exacerbation of wealth-based healthcare disparities in the U.S. during the coronavirus pandemic. It says that poorer counties saw deaths at almost twice the rate of wealthier counties. The research was carried out by Poor People's Campaign, which focuses on income inequality in the U.S. It said the death rate in poorer countries was five times higher than richer countries during U.S.'s fourth coronavirus wave, which was caused by the Delta variant. The report found that many of the 300 counties with the highest death rates had a higher percentage of people of color and an average poverty rate of 45%. The campaign's director called the findings shameful, adding that the neglect of poor people in the U.S. during a pandemic is immoral, shocking, and unjust. The U.S. is the only industrialized nation not providing health services for everybody. Nearly 1 million Americans have died of COVID, more than any other country in the world. Frank Imspach is an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. We earlier asked him about the situation of income and healthcare inequality in the U.S. Here's what he had to say.
55 years ago today, Martin Luther King spoke at Riverside Church in New York City. He spoke against the war in Vietnam, but that's not the only thing he was talking about. He made the point very, very clearly that we were a nation that was unequal in all respects, and singled out in particular the situation with poor people and people of color, that in every aspect of our society, they were disadvantaged in all kinds of different ways. So that was 55 years ago. And the situation, if anything, in terms of wealth inequality, has only gotten worse. The healthcare is one aspect, longevity is another. The issue of infant mortality is a third. Every single possible social measure has a racial component to it in this country. And generally, the blacker you are, the worse the outcomes. And that has been true now for some time. The Kerner Report in the mid-60s, that was why are people revolting, that was what, and commissioned by the federal government, called for huge investments in social services in this country. And that was simply not done. And each time we've had this discussion, it has been overshadowed by increased spending for war.
And that does for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly criticized the cinematic art of the previous regime, as it was one of the main sources of immorality in society, particularly among the young generation. He correctly believed that the dramatic arts, mainly cinema, were the tools of colonial policies of the West and anti-Islamic propaganda of the U.S. and its accomplices in the country. This week, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on political parties and groups, which were, in fact, the puppets of the big powers in Iran. Stay tuned, please. During the years of struggle against the despotic Pahlavi regime in Iran, different groups resorted to various methods to topple the ruling system. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or MKO, was one of those groups which tried to change the political system via armed struggle. The MKO was formed in 1965 with combination of two contradictory ideologies of Islam and Marxism. This organization managed to take a few terrorist acts against the regime, but in 1971, many of its leaders were identified, tortured, or executed by the intelligence apparatus of the regime, called SAVAK. In 1975, some of the MKO ringleaders, through an organizational coup, officially changed the ideology of the group led to Marxism and committed gruesome murders against their opponents thereafter. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there emerged differences of opinion among the MKO leaders and the revolutionary leaders, to the extent that, following the dismissal of President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr by the parliament, the MKO started armed activities against the Islamic Republic system and martyred a number of officials and thousands of civilians. After the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, the MKO terrorist outfit transferred its base to Iraq and continued its measures against the Iranian nation. Some of the Western countries tried to put the name of the MKO in the blacklist of terrorist groups to stop its crimes against humanity. But through the pressures of influential regimes, especially the United States, they failed to pursue their demands. The terrorist outfit has been employed by Washington, Tel Aviv, and London as a tool to pursue their nefarious goals against the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic system. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My advice and recommendation to the grouplets and persons who are active against the nation, the Islamic Republic and Islam, first in addressing their ringleaders inside and outside the country, is that the long experience of taking any measure, designing any plot, and resorting to any country and official should have taught to you who consider yourselves as knowledgeable and wise that the course of a selfless nation cannot be misled by resorting to terror, blast, bomb, and baseless and uncalculated lies. Never can any state and government be toppled through inhumane and illogical methods. especially a nation like Iran, whose young children to its old women and men are sacrificing their lives in the way of the goal, the Islamic Republic, the Quran, and religion. You know, and if you do not, you are thinking very naively that the nation is not with you and the army is not with you. And if you suppose that they had been with you as your friends, your bungling acts and crimes that have occurred through your provocation have separated them from you, and you have failed to do anything except forging enemies, unquote. Imam Khomeini, addressing terrorist groups, especially the MKO, writes in another part of his testament, "In the end of my life, I benevolently recommend you who have started fighting and countering this afflicted nation, which has saved itself from the oppression of criminals like the Pahlavi regime and the world devourers of the East and the West through sacrificing their best children and youth. How can the conscience of a human, no matter how wicked it is, to be content for the likely achieving of a position to behave his country and his nation in this way and does not have mercy towards their young and the elderly?" The Imam advises the ringleaders of these grouplets not to be deceived by big powers. He writes, "I advise you to give up such useless and unwise acts and not be gulled by the world devourers. And wherever you are, if you have committed crime, return to your country and the lap of Islam. Repent, as God is the most merciful of the merciful, and the Islamic Republic and the nation will, inshallah, forgive you. And if you have committed a crime that God has determined your decree, still return from halfway and return. Or if you are not brave enough, accept the punishment, and hence, save yourselves from God's painful punishment. Otherwise, wherever you are, do not waste your life anymore and embark on another job as it is to your benefit." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the internal and external advocates of the MKO terrorist grouplet, writes in his testament, "Then I recommend their internal and external advocates, for what motive do you waste your youth for those whom have been proved to be serving the powerful world devourers and follow their schemes and have been fallen in their traps? In whose way are you wronging your own nation? You are the beguiled of them, and if you are in Iran, you're witnessing that the million-strong masses are loyal to the Islamic Republic and sacrifice for it. And you are witnessing that the current state and regime are wholeheartedly at the service of the destitute. And those who are spuriously feigning popularity, being mujahid and devotees of the people, have embarked on enmity against God's people and have beguiled you simple boys and girls for their purposes and the purposes of one of the world-devouring poles of power. Whereas they are either reveling in the lap of one of the criminal poles or inside the country They are leading a luxurious life in team houses like the houses of the wretched criminals while sending you youths to death. My kind advice to you teenagers and youth inside and outside is to return from the wrong way and be united with the deprived of the society who are serving the Islamic Republic wholeheartedly. And be active for the independent and free Iran, to that the country and the nation get rid of the evil of the opponents and all continue noble life together. How long and why will you be subordinate to those who do not think except for their vested interest? You are fighting your nation in the lap of the superpowers while they have sacrificed you for their sinister purposes and seeking power.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is something Iran has accused the U.S. of before, yet the U.S. has failed in that regard, failing in making political decisions, which Iran has said has led to a halt in the Vienna talks. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Iranian accusations against the U.S., one in which Iran has said that the U.S. is trying to hold the remaining issues hostage to its internal affairs. What those internal affairs are, and the chances of the JCPOA revival talks' success, are other issues we will look at in this edition of The Spotlight. Get the latest. First, we're going to cross on over to Vienna and talk to our correspondent, Homolesky. Homolesky, at this point, we know that Iran is very critical of the U.S., not that it has not been before, but at this stage, it is pretty important. Tell us why.
Yeah, so let's look at the comments that have been made by Iranian top Iranian officials, the foreign minister himself, the foreign ministry spokesman, saying that when very recently Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator, came to Iran, the Iranians gave him the message or the response or the proposals on how to resolve the remaining issues. The red lines were clear. How far Iran was willing to go was clear. Now it's the U.S. that has to respond, and it has not done so. Here in Vienna, there were reports, of course, that the media tent outside the Coburg Palais Hotel is being dismantled. And in response to media reports about speculations as to what this means for the fate of the negotiations, the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, tweeted saying that because everything basically has already been written, the texts are already, and there are just these remaining issues between the Iranians and the Americans, once and if these issues are resolved, there'd only be a requirement for the participants to have a very short, in his words, meeting to announce formally the decision that they want to revive the JCPOA. But what Iran is asking now is the U.S. really willing to do that? Does it want the JCPOA to be revived? Because if it does, it has to adopt a realistic approach. It has to announce the political decision. What are the remaining issues? From various reports we're hearing, that it includes the scope of sanctions, the extent of sanctions that need to be rolled back, including those affecting Iran's IRGC, as well as guarantees that any future U.S. president would not withdraw from the JCPOA. So what we're seeing now in terms of how analysts, commentators are viewing the situation, they're saying this is the Biden administration that came into the White House with the campaign promise to undo what the Trump administration did when it came to the JCPOA. Mr. Biden was vehemently against the move by President Trump to withdraw from the JCPOA, but now they say he's effectively exploiting that decision and increasing pressure on Iran, especially since the U.S. also very recently introduced new sanctions on individuals and companies in Iran. Is there a will on the American side, Iran is asking, to make this happen? Because if they do resolve these very few issues that all participants believe can be resolved, then it is still realistic to assume that the JCPOA can actually, you know, come back to life.
Thank you very much for that. Homa Lesky there from Vienna. We do appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have political analyst Saeed Mostafa Hoshesh, who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, writer and political analyst John White, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Saeed Mostafa Hoshesh. Iran has made some statements, and let's look at one of them, if you can break it down for us as to what it means. Khatibzadeh, the Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson, saying all of us should not forget that what we are facing today is not an administration that wants to perform its duties, but rather one that seeks to exploit legal means in order not to honor its obligations. What is he saying there?
Well, thanks for having me. If you just take a look at what the Biden administration has been doing, it's just a continuation of the maximum pressure policy that came into effect under Donald Trump. Before even Biden came to office, Bolton, the former national security advisor, as well as many other Trump administration officials, acknowledged that the maximum pressure policy has failed. Also, the Biden administration, Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Biden himself, they have all acknowledged that this policy has failed to produce any kind of result for the United States verbally. But when it comes into action, they still continue the same kind of policy. They continue the carrot and stick. They still continue imposing sanctions on Iran. And they're not at all apparently worried about the negotiations, since we are at the final stage of the talks. And they still continue imposing further sanctions on Iran and Iranians. So what they are doing basically is continuing Donald Trump's strategy. They are not really very much willing for honoring their duties and undertakings under the JCPOA. Otherwise, it wouldn't have required us to go into negotiations. They could have easily done that as soon as Biden came to office. He could have, resumed compliance with the terms of the JCPOA last year, even without the talks, because we are talking about very specific and clear and transparent undertakings of the United States and Iran under the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. But the Americans are not willing to, relinquish their weapon of choice. That's the sanctions. That's why the talks have been stalled.
John White, we are looking at a date here of March 27th. That's when Enrique Mora, after visiting Tehran, departed with messages. He had met with high-ranking Iranian officials, including the Iranian foreign minister. And he left with messages from Tehran to Washington. Yes. And according to what Iran is saying that we're still waiting for the answers from the other side. Mind you, that Iran did obviously make sure to, again, make it clear that the lack of the ability for the U.S. to make a political decision to remove the sanctions that are tied to economic benefits of the Iranian people is the only existing obstacle. at that point is what the Iranian foreign minister said to Enrique Mora. If that's the case, why is the U.S. not answering?
Well, thanks for having me. It's quite extraordinary that we've reached this point with regards to these negotiations in Vienna. On an objective, moral, ethical level, the U.S. should have long before now lifted the sanctions of Iran and agreed to resuscitate the JCPOA on the same terms as it was agreed initially in 2015. And Iran's foreign minister is absolutely correct when he says that Joe Biden is being held hostage by his own internal politics. His approval ratings have gone through the floor, now down to 39%. He's perceived by more and more Americans, from their point of view, as a weak leader. The Afghanistan debacle, from their point of view, in August last year, he's tried to play a strong card against Russia vis-a-vis the Ukraine conflict. That's only exacerbated the suffering of the American working class in terms of rising fuel prices and food prices. So it's quite inexplicable, if you understand this on a certain level, that the Biden administration will not acquiesce to Iran's reasonable demands. But you know what? Joe Biden has his biggest enemy is not Russia, it's not Iran, it's Donald Trump. And Trump is breathing down his shoulder. And this is where we are now with American politics. Joe Biden and the Democrats understand that Trump is likely to be re-elected in 2024 unless he plays tough with Iran vis-a-vis how Donald Trump did. And this is where the problem lies. The Iranians have nothing to apologize for. Joe Biden and his administration are being led down this path to perdition by Donald Trump and the pressure raid against him from the Republicans in the US itself. It's a very sad state of affairs, but this is reality of a declining hegemonic power.
Well, I was going to ask this later, but let's get down to it, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, regarding what John White is saying there. First of all, it's one of the guarantees that Iran does want is if a new administration does come, it needs to have some kind of guarantee that it's not going to rip up the agreement. But tell us about the deal with Congress. What is that all about? I'm looking at one particular source, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, which says the president, Biden, will get his way because it's unlikely that Congress is going to be able to block a new agreement. And it refers back, based on this source and many other sources, actually, to when Obama actually went through and finally got its approval for the JCPOA at that point. So where does that stand?
You know, it's true that part of the problem comes from the very fact that the Biden administration is stuck with internal political disputes and rivalries and the problems that he might have domestically and especially at the Congress. But part of the fact is this point, that this is a U.S. strategy towards Iran. It's not just the Biden administration. It's not the Donald Trump administration policy. It's the U.S. policy that came into effect under Obama, even 9 months before Obama came to office. This is the containment strategy. They do not want a conflict resolution with Iran. Let's remember that Iran and the U.S. or its European allies, they have had six cases of agreements in the past two decades. One over Afghanistan, the other one in 2003 over Iraq, three others with European states from 2003 to 2005, and the last one being the JCPOA in 2015. In all of them, according to U.S. officials and experts, Iran has been in full compliance with its undertakings because Iran has always believed in a conflict resolution approach, and it has believed, rightly or wrongly, that the deal is for conflict resolution. But the United States and its allies, they have never been in compliance with the terms of all these deals, mainly removal of sanctions, because they have never meant to go for a conflict resolution approach. What they've been doing is going for a deal in line or in the framework of containment strategy. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means if we have a nuclear deal and everyone sticks to the deal, then they need to contain Iran's power components with regard to its missile industry, regional power, and its laser industry, nanotechnology, aerospace program, and so on and so forth. Because what they want to do is containing Iran's power. So the best weapon of choice that they've got in here is the sanctions. So they always remain adamant to removing the sanctions. And now, right now, what is the problem with the talks that we don't see a deal? It's removal of sanctions on certain Iranian entities, legal and real persons. That includes actually Iranian individuals, firms, and entities that have been placed in the red list. And the U.S., which agreed a few months ago to remove them from the red list, has shown buyer's remorse. That's a known or notorious U.S. negotiating tactic. They have been doing this buyer's remorse all the time whenever they come to a deal with Iran and to the talks with Iran. Here, we are through with 97% of issues. But these the 3% left, this is very important, because if they remove this part of the sanctions from the red list of entities, firms, and individuals, then Iran would have a great more economic merits from such a deal, and they do not want it to happen because they want to keep the sanctions structure intact. They might suspend some sanctions, but they do not want Iran to enjoy the full merits of any possible deal. That's why they are adamant to doing what is right.
Right. Well, let's talk about these sanctions that obviously they never come at a good time, but this is really at a very sensitive time, John White. And what message am I going to ask you this sense? And particularly when we take a look also at the other angle of these sanctions, where it was basically on individuals and companies that are linked to Iran's ballistic missile program for providing assistance to Iran's ballistic missile program. I mean, they're targeting the defense of a country. You know, that's something that is Iran's red lines. So why would they go through with these sanctions?
Well, these are non-nuclear issues. These are incompatible with the original terms of the JCPOA that did not cover non-nuclear issues regarding, for example, as you just mentioned, Iran's ballistic missile program. Iran has a legitimate security interests, and they have a duty bound to their own people to uphold these security interests. This is trying to neuter Iran as a strong power in the region, and it's also a backhanded compliment, if I may say, to Iran's growing influence in the region as a pillar of stability in a region that's been mired in instability since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But let's not be under any illusions. This is not just about US foreign policy. This is about Saudi and Israeli foreign policy. And they are having a major influence on the Biden administration's stance vis-a-vis these negotiations in Vienna. And it's a very sad state of affairs when you have a US president unsteady on his feet, cognitively challenged, who's struggling to maintain his own foreign policy. It is quite significant that his calls to the UAE and Saudi Arabia recently, in the context of the Ukraine conflict, to try and get them to produce more oil to stabilize energy prices globally, were refused. That is quite unprecedented when you think about Washington's relationship and its influence in the Middle East. It is a waning power, and Joe Biden is a symptom of that waning power. So my suggestion to Iran, if I can say, is to stay firm, stand strong, and see this out, because the US is not the future. And I think the Iranian government and its institutions understand that. And that's why they're insisting that they will not budge from their demand that before anything can be agreed in Vienna, all sanctions must be lifted in accordance with the 2015 agreement.
Okay, let's get to one of the core issues that seems to be at hand here, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, and tell us if it is, because there are many that Iran has pointed out to. But when it comes to the IRGC, we're looking at obviously a red line and a key sticking point, and it doesn't make sense how this is a sticking point where it's a red line. And I'm going to put this into context and then ask you, how could this even be resolved in terms of it being on the terrorist list organization, as the U.S. has done, when the U.S. Special Envoy, Robert Malley, has said that sanctions on the IRGC would remain in place even if an agreement to restore the deal is reached?
Okay. First of all, this is not the main point that has been left. This is it is one of the very few points that have been left. The most important issue, as I just said, is removing sanctions on specific legal and real persons that includes firms, individuals, and entities in the SDN list or the so-called red list. That's a part of the SDN list. That they remain adamant to removing the sanctions on these, individuals and entities, because removing sanctions from these entities, individuals, and firms would enhance economic merits for Iran under any possible view. And this is very important, because, and I'll explain about it. Removing, IRGC from the list. The IRGC has been tagged multiple times. If I'm not mistaken, under four tags, it's been sanctioned. One of them is the SDGT. If they remove this tag, there will be economic merits for Iran. But when it comes to FTO, or foreign terrorist organization, because of supporting resistant movements in the region, this is just a political tag. It doesn't include economic merits. It's just a political sanctions. It is the worst. It's the worst type of, tag or sanction on, any country or an organization or a military, an official military of a country. And by the way, the IRGC is the official military, the army of Iran, and no other military in the world has been sanctioned by the U.S. or any other country. This is something very illegal, like other U.S. sanctions on Iran and other countries and companies throughout the world. But this FTO, as I just said, is just a political tag. If they remove it, it means a very great defeat for the United States that tagged the IRGC on their FTO a couple of years ago. Actually, not couple, but in 2018, they placed it under the FTO in the FTO list. But its removal would not entail any economic merits for Iran. That's why I and some other experts insist that Iran should also continue its insistence on removing the SDGT tag as well. This is one of the other key issues. I'm not hearing about it very often in the media, but this is one more point that needs to go under discussions. And in a few more months, as the global developments are, especially with regard to the Russian confrontation with the West over Ukraine, as things are developing, especially in the energy market, soon we will see that if there is to be a deal, definitely the United States would be required to do more and to give more points and to give more merits, including removing of the SDGT from the IRGC.
John White, this administration is very keen, and Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, while running for presidency, said that we are going to enhance our relations with our neighbors, and it's doing so, and we can see the results. One of them being the major one, I'm guessing here, which is still in the works somewhat, is its relation with Saudi Arabia. Of course, we have that major development come where the Iranian Foreign Minister, Amir Abdullahian, spoke to the UN Secretary General Guterres and spoke about the JCPOA revival talks, and also the fact that there was a ceasefire between Yemen, the official government of Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, a ceasefire for 2 months at this point. Do you think then that this is something that may lead to, I guess I'm just going to say, the U.S. realizing that Iran is taking the right steps in order to regionally calm things down, because it's doing all it can diplomatically with its neighbors, yeah, or not?
Well, in the West, in the context of the conflict in Ukraine, ideology has superseded pragmatism, and that's always a bad position to be. That is the road to perdition. And I think Iran is an absolute arbiter of pragmatism over ideology. Iran is willing to forge bilateral productive relations with all its neighbours, including Saudi Arabia, despite all the enmity that has existed between those two countries for many, many years. And I think that pragmatism will always trump, no pun intended, ideology in the last analysis. I think the US has to understand If it tries to cancel Russia and its energy supplies, it has to allow Iran's oil to be a part of the world energy market in order to stabilize global prices, because ultimately, when people go to fill their cars up in California or New York or any part of the US, that will determine the political trajectory of that country. And the Biden administration must understand that it must acquiesce to the reality of the condition of the American people in terms of its economy. And that is a problem that Biden has.
Right.
He's been pushed by ideologues in his own administration in Washington to take these very radical steps, and it's going to be his undoing.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. But thank you for that, John White, writer and political analyst. Said Mostafa Khoshesh, also thank you for your input. Political analyst spoke to us from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakwe and the entire team, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. In today's session, we will continue our discussion on the differences and the alterations in recitations of the Holy Quran. Now, just to give a quick summary, these differences that are present in the Holy Quran, they are not caused, how should we say this, by the Quran itself, by there being different versions. No, the words are the same, but the way that they are read and recited differed throughout the time and ages, and that is because the way the Quran was written differed. One such example is that the letters, they may be the same, but in Arabic, as Arabic speakers and people familiar with the language know, you can have different letters that can change based on the vowels, based on the dots that you place above or beneath them. So because the Arabs, for example, they didn't place these dots, later on we had some confusion on how these were to be recited. We mentioned the last difference there, Sheikh, and that was that in the Kufi scripture, the Kufi style of writing, if an alif is placed or is present in the middle of a word, it is not written. Exactly. If you please could expand upon that.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, for example, we have the word sin, mim, wav, and ta. Can you guess what this word is? Sin, mim, wav, and ta. Can you guess what is
sin, mim, wav, and ta?
Yeah. This is samawat, but they didn't write two alifs.
Right.
So what we see is sin, mim, wav, and ta, but it is samawat. They omitted two alifs. So again, they knew that we do not have samut, for example, in Arabic language.
That's what I was confused about. Like what?
But in some cases, it made some confusions because two ways of reciting were possible. Let me give you some examples. So for example, we have the word ha, ra, and mim, which can be haram if they omitted alif,
right?
Or it can be harrama or hurrama
without
alif. Right. So that is why in the verse "Haramun ala qaryatin ahlaknaha annahum la yarji'un," some recited it as haramun and some as harrama or hurrama. And وَإِذْ وَعَدْنَا. It is written as Wab Ain Dal. So some people recited it as وَإِذْ وَعَدْنَا, and some people as وَعُدْنَا or وَعَدْنَا. Sorry, right. وَعَدْنَا. Or فِي غَيَابَةِ الْجُبْ or غَيَابَاتِ الْجُبْ.
Right.
So you see, because of the fact that in the middle of the word, the alephs were not written, later people, face